Good afternoon. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, the Subcommittee on Public Safety. I'm opening up the public hearing. It's April 3rd, 2017. Public hearing on House Bill 5015, Department of Justice, and I believe that Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum's here. So I will call her up, Mr. While she's coming up, will LFO start us off, Mr.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee, the Department of Justice will be with you for the next 4 days. For the next 3 days, they will. For the next 3 days, they will cover their operating programs. There are 11 main operating programs, and then on the fourth day will be the Chief Financial Office presentation of the governor's budget, and then public testimony. And so, with that, Madam Chair.
It's all yours. Yeah, I lost my voice a little bit.
Thank you. Good afternoon, co-chairs Winters and Stark, and members of the subcommittee. My name's Ellen Rosenblum, and I'm the Oregon Attorney General. And I am delighted to have this opportunity to introduce you to the Oregon Department of Justice. Our mission is to provide essential justice services to state government in order to support safe and healthy communities throughout Oregon. We are proud to be the state's lawyers. It is our role to uphold the rule of law, safeguard consumers from fraud and unfair business practices, protect children and look out for families, supervise charities, fight crime, advocate for crime victims, provide state agencies with quality legal advice and representation, handle the state's appeals, and much more. As you know, in addition to our budget, we have been busy with several key policy initiatives. I have been honored to chair two task forces, one on law enforcement profiling and another on public records law reform, both of which are bringing forward important proposals this session. I also want to thank you for supporting our new elder abuse unit, which is now up and running. The Oregon Department of Justice has 9 divisions, including the Attorney General's office, shown near the top of this slide. During our presentations over the next few days, my staff will explain the important work done in each division. They will also present the governor's budget for their divisions. We in the Department of Justice are keenly aware of the difficult budget projection for Oregon state government, and we deeply respect your role in making the very difficult decisions that need to be made to fund state government for the coming biennium. I welcome your questions about my agency throughout this budget process. So if questions for me arise later, I will be happy to address them as they come up. At this time, if you have no questions for me, I would like to introduce Fred Boss, my Deputy Attorney General, who will present an overview of the agency and its budget.
Co-chairs Winters and Stark, and members of the subcommittee, my name is Fred Boss. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As the Attorney General mentioned, the Oregon Department of Justice contains 9 divisions. Each of the divisions perform a variety of important work, and our division administrators will tell you about these activities over the next 3 or 4 days. This graph shows the governor's budget at a high level for the 9 divisions and the Defense of Criminal Convictions account. In total, the governor's budget for the Department of Justice expenditures is $612 million. Of this amount, around 53% is other funds, 33% is federal funds, and 14% is general fund. The largest part of the agency's budget is for the Division of Child Support. The breakdown of the Department of this is the breakdown of the department by full-time equivalent. Again, note that the Division of Child Support is almost one half of the department.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Can you just clarify that a little bit for me, please? Does that mean that 41% of your budget is spent just in the Child Support Enforcement Division?
Because they do collection.
Well, I understand they do collections, but you don't do collections on everybody. You only do collections on the people who don't comply, right? If people comply, you don't know about them.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Senator Hayward, we actually do everybody.
Everybody?
Everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody who has a child support order can and almost always does use the Oregon Department of Justice. We collect over $1 million a day, $365 million a year. And people in the public have the thought that perhaps we are out there collecting it. Actually, it's a payment system. And even if there are two folks who have never been on public assistance that are divorced, they can use the Oregon Department of Justice as a payment tracking system.
Follow up.
If I might ask co-chairs, Senator Steiner Hayward, it's a very good question because it kind of seems like, well, why would it be that much work if people are just cooperating and sending in their money, right? Why would you need to do that much? But the fact of the matter is, and I would like, of course, Kate Cooper Richardson to give you the details when she makes her presentation, uh-huh. which will be later this week, to explain to you all the various ways in which we intersect with families. Sure. We establish paternity. We work on health insurance issues. We have locators who locate the individuals who are not so easy to find. We work with families, primarily fathers, but also mothers, to ensure that they are getting access to their children for visitation so that they will be more likely to cooperate mm-hmm. with their orders. We also engage in with our lawyers in potentially all the way up to contempt proceedings, but certainly other types of legal proceedings to ensure that monies come in. So there's a lot of voluntary aspects to the child support program, but there's a whole lot of work that we do in order to ensure that the money continues to come in regularly. And I can assure you that later this week, Ms. Cooper
Richardson
will provide
that. I'll look forward to learning more as we go along. That was a surprise, so it's good to learn more.
We have 11 child support offices throughout the state, by the way.
Thank you.
This slide shows our projected revenue. The billings to our clients are the single highest source of revenue for our department. Federal support for the Division of Child Support is the second largest source. We have 16 performance measures. 11 are very close to their targets or exceeding their budget. These are the measures that are directly managed by the Department of Justice. Of the remaining five, four are having some challenges achieving their targets, and one is in the red zone. Our customers, who are the state agencies, are very satisfied with our services. We survey them yearly, and this reflects their satisfaction with our services. The governor's budget included many of the agency's budget priorities in the 17-19 biennium. This shows a summary of what was included. Our division administrators' presentations will provide more information on a division-by-division basis. In addition to the work funded by the governor's budget, we would like to be able to accomplish other work that was not funded by the governor's budget. This slide provides a list of requests that would accomplish that additional work. This slide shows the rates we are charging in this biennium and the rates used for the governor's budget for the upcoming biennium. As shown on slide 5, or the last slide, legal billings are projected to raise around $207 million dollars of revenue to pay for the agency's legal division activities during the upcoming biennium. I would like now to briefly talk about the Attorney General's office. This office directs the operations of the agency and helps accomplish various duties of the Office of Attorney General. It establishes legal policy, manages communications and legislative coordination, reaches out to Oregonians on consumer education and civil rights, oversees internal audits, and manages the department's budget. The AG's office includes 26 positions, of which 10 are honors attorneys. And finally, I would like to add a few comments about the priorities of the agency for the upcoming biennium. We will continue to provide quality legal services to state agencies. As you will hear from our Civil Enforcement Division, we want to expand legal representation for Department of Human Services caseworkers and continue protecting Oregon's consumers. We want to continue to provide benefits to crime victims. Finally, it is one of our highest priorities to protect the resources, both natural and fiscal, of our state. Thank you for your attention, and I would be happy to address any of your questions. If you have no questions, our next presenter will be Michael Slauson, the Chief Counsel of our Criminal Justice Division.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Winters and Stark, members of the committee. My name is Michael Slauson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I serve in the role of Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. Very pleased to be before you today to talk about the work of our division. The Criminal Justice Division is responsible for performing the law enforcement and prosecutorial functions of the Department of Justice. We currently have 60 employees. And our objective is to utilize our unique structure of prosecutors, sworn law enforcement officers, and crime analysts to enhance public safety efforts across the state and to combat crime. The division is organized into three sections. We have the Special Investigations and Prosecution section, the Organized Crime section, and the Criminal Information Services section. When I talk about the functions of the Criminal Justice Division today, I want to focus on the functions that are supported by general funds and not specifically those supported by federal funds, but I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee might have about any of our functions. But before I turn to the
Is there a reason why you don't, because so often sometimes there may be some federal funding, but the activity actually would include general funds as well?
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, if there is a combination of federal
I'm thinking
funds
of hiding some
funds.
Of those things where we work with the feds.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, I can talk about HIDA. I do have a HIDA slide. It's something we do work with the federal government on, a federally funded position. I'd be happy to talk about that. So, but before I get to the specific sections of the division, I did want to spend a few moments talking about some specific significant public safety challenges that we face in Oregon and what our division does to address those as we go through the different sections. So the first one are crimes involving vulnerable victims, investigations and prosecutions involving the most vulnerable among us. Cases like elder abuse are very challenging. It requires a lot of experience, know-how, technical skills, because they often involve a lot of difficult and challenging factual issues and evidentiary issues. And then some of the local DA's offices with high pressing caseloads and a lot of turnover, it's difficult to develop a lot of competency in those areas.
Can you walk us through from the genesis of a case to from the and how that reaches the Attorney General's office?
Absolutely. Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee. Generally, when we're talking about, we have two different programs that we'll cover over. We have the District Attorney Assistance Program, and we have the Organized Crime section in the District Attorney.
I'm specifically thinking of elder abuse.
So how we would generate elder abuse cases would be coming through working with local law enforcement officers and with the district attorneys, and that what they do is they will call and ask us for technical assistance, perhaps. They might ask, how do we handle a case? How do I get bank records? And then as the case becomes more complex or they just need extra help, we will actually take over the investigation and, if necessary, the prosecution in those cases.
Have we taken over investigations?
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, we have. Yes. In addition to the exploitation of vulnerable victims as being a particular challenge, so too is the complexity of organized crime in Oregon. members of criminal organizations are becoming more and more sophisticated. Combating them is a very resource-intensive endeavor, requires a lot of collaboration. They're very adept at hiding assets. They're very good at counter-surveillance techniques. They're good at hiding assets, and it requires a lot of coordination and effort among law enforcement and use of specific tools like racketeering. The other enduring challenge to prosecutors and law enforcement across the state is a rapidly evolving case law. Knowing what the law is, understanding the law, being able to apply it consistently is essential. And with the ever-changing landscape legally for us, especially dealing with technology, it's very important that prosecutors and law enforcement are on top of it because the consequences are so severe. It could result in exclusion of evidence or, in some cases, dismissal. Last thing I wanted to talk about is an enduring public safety challenge in Oregon is maintaining public trust and accountability in government. Citizens in Oregon just must have confidence that there is a central location, an independent body that can fairly and thoroughly investigate allegations involving public officials. So I want to start off talking a little bit about our District Attorney Assistance Program. This program was established in 1964, and it helps to assist the district attorneys both in the prosecution in cases and investigation of cases. Expert trial assistance is an important part of the program. Our assistant attorneys general are extremely experienced prosecutors with a lot of background and skill in prosecuting major felonies. This type of service is generally offered to those, or generally utilized, I should say, by the medium to smaller counties, even though the larger counties do use from time to time. But it's the smaller counties that have the limited budgets and personnel to tackle some of these bigger crimes that rely on us most often. The investigative assistance that we provide is provided by criminal justice investigators. Their working title is our special agents. Basically, what they are detectives with our highly skilled and trained police officers. And their objective and their role in the state is not to supplant local law enforcement efforts, but to actually enhance them and tackle tough issues that are not being addressed locally. Talking about things like financial crimes, things that require specific expertise. And I would say also we talk about resource prosecutors, something I'd like to mention as part of this program. All of the assistant attorney general in the criminal justice division have expertise. We have an expert, for instance, in shaken baby cases. But we do have certain prosecutors who have subject matter expertise and focus their work in that specific area. And I'm going to talk about them separately in another slide, but I did want to mention that here. The other thing I wanted to mention about the District Attorney Assistance Program is that when called on to do so by the governor, we fill vacancies in DA's offices when a DA leaves office for any various number of reasons. Last fall, we served for 3 months as a District Attorney of the Malheur County District Attorney's Office, and we're currently serving as the Klamath County District Attorney. You can imagine that it makes it difficult for us sometimes because it's hard to know when that duty is going to come up, but we take it very seriously. And because of that, what we try to do is rather than have multiple people serve in that role, we have one person. Because when we do take on that role, we're responsible for all the duties of the district attorney, including management decisions and budget-related decisions. The other one of the challenges, as I mentioned earlier, is about the difficulty with the rapidly evolving legal standards is that we do provide around-the-clock legal advice to district attorneys and to prosecutors. That could be a phone call from a panicked prosecutor in the middle of a trial, maybe has 10 minutes from the court to make a call and figure out what to do in the courtroom. It could be help. Maybe somebody calls and asks for help drafting a motion. Maybe it's a new technical issue. It could be motion to suppress, use of cell phone evidence, something like that. We might help them walk through that. It could be sometimes there's a department, because we're so well connected to those in the public safety community, we can identify some issues and help try to get out in front of them. So, for instance, we see some issues about handling of evidence and whether it raises a Brady issue. We do those kinds of things where we bring people together to talk about how do we deal with this on a statewide level to help set some standards. So what's so critical about this type of service is that we really help prosecutors make the right call when they need to make the right call. And so not only does that help preserve a defendant's rights or a suspect's rights in a particular case, it helps preserve or preserve resources so we're not doing unnecessary appeals or retrials.
Do you have, we've got 36 counties and 36 DAs, and do you have one county more than others that utilizes your services?
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, it depends on what kind of services we're talking about. I have a couple slides that talk about that, because I think what you'd be surprised about is that when it comes to some of these service assist calls for where they call in, you'll find that Multnomah County, for instance, is the biggest county in the state, perhaps the most sophisticated, maybe.
That depends on who you're talking to.
It depends on who you're talking to. But they call as much as any of the other counties, if not more. And what's interesting, I do from time to time, having taken a number of these calls myself, so I get some folks from the eastern side of the state feel a bit apologetic that they're using our services too much when they call and say, oh, I'm sorry we call so much. But, you know, Multnomah County does call as much as anybody. And when it comes to trial services, yes, generally it's going to be those smaller and medium-sized counties, but even the larger counties, as I'll have some examples, do use this as well. So in addition to the legal advice that we give to help secure the integrity of convictions, we also do training. And from this slide, you can see we've conducted 130 trainings in this last biennium. Over 850 police officers and prosecutors trained. That's over a training a week. And the cornerstone of our training are two advanced institutes. We have an advanced institute for new prosecutors. We call it the Baby DA School. And nearly every prosecutor in the state goes through this course. It's a week-long course that teaches them basic trial advocacy skills, ethical skills, just how to be a prosecutor. Then we also offer an advanced prosecutor's course, which is for more seasoned prosecutors dealing with more complex issues. So as I mentioned earlier, I was going to talk about our resource prosecutors. We have DUI resource prosecutors. We have two of them. They're federally funded positions. We also have a domestic violence resource prosecutor. That is funded through the Crime Victim Services Division. So I want to spend my time here today to talk specifically about the elder abuse resource prosecutor position. But again, I'd be happy to answer any questions that committee might have.
When did you bring that position on board? Because we passed legislation, what was it?
16.
In 2016.
Co-Chair Winters, member of the committee, Dan Norris, who's a former Malheur County District Attorney, took the position in October. Okay. So what is so critical about these elder abuse position is that it requires specific expertise to handle these types of cases, that our aging population can be victimized through physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, there could be financial exploitation. And so in addition to Dan Norris, who is the resource prosecutor, we have two special agents. One is an expert in physical trauma and dealing with vulnerable victims, and the other one is a financial expert. So any case that comes in, any question that comes at us, we have the ability to answer.
Can I ask you a programmatic question? Because just recently, the long-term care ombudsman was in, making their presentation, but also I had them come to my office to talk about the work that they're doing, and particularly because part of their system is also some of the same kinds of issues. And my question to them was, you know, how were they reporting, number one, and how were they actually interfacing with others who actually are doing some of the similar kind of work, and how were we identifying trends and clusters of problems as it dealt with this particular subject? So you engaged at all with the long-term care ombudsman director?
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, I can't say for certain because I haven't asked Mr. Norris a specific question, but I'm going to guess that he is, but I will follow up and get an answer to that. But I can tell you what we have done that I know, which is Dan has gone around the state with the investigators and met with the local MDT groups that deal with elder abuse, and has reached out and has worked with Ellen Clem, who works in the Attorney General's office, to identify where the needs are in the state.
If I could also try to respond to your question, Madam Co-Chair, we also have a Medicaid fraud unit that works separate from, but they, I know, communicate with each other, our elder abuse unit. And that unit, I believe, does directly connect up with the long-term care world.
Can I encourage you to have some conversation with the long-term care ombudsman, because they have this cadre of volunteers in the communities across the state that are, you know, in nursing homes and foster care systems and what have you, specifically, you know, to actually follow up on complaints and what have you. And their eyes and ears, you know, are another set that, you know, can identify some problems. And for me, it's kind of like bringing everybody together rather than having all these pieces out there and what have you. And I know that in some cases they've been able to, you know, I think Clackamas County has been engaged in a couple of high-profile cases that had to do with elder abuse and financial fraud. So I'm just a suggestion that you may want to have some conversation with Mr. Steele over in the long-term care to see how there may be some compatibilities of working together.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, absolutely.
Co-Chair. Yes. Co-Chair Stark.
Thank you, Co-Chair Winters. I may not be, my brain's not tracking as fast as it should be. A few minutes ago, under the assistance programs and so forth, did you say that you guys are currently providing a DA for Malheur County?
Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, no, we did that between October and the beginning of January. We're currently serving in the capacity of the Klamath County District Attorney.
Okay. There for a moment, I'm like, wait a minute. So he comes to work for you, and then you provide one for them. But, okay, carry on.
Yes.
Just for about a month.
Yeah. So what I was speaking of before is the expertise it requires to handle these types of crimes involving elder abuse. And one of the most challenging parts about it is the family dynamic. Because unfortunately, in many of these cases, the perpetrator or the abuser is a close family member of the victim. And so what happens in those types of cases, it becomes very unclear. Is what's going on in this particular situation a crime? Is it a civil matter? Is it a misunderstanding among family members? And really, that is where we come in the elder abuse and resource prosecutors, and speaking specifically about elder abuse now, but this is the same thing with DUII, and it's the same thing with the domestic violence. So in a case, say, for instance, a case comes in where local law enforcement hears an allegation that an adult son is maybe financially exploiting an elder parent, and during an initial investigation finds that there's a power of attorney. We have been hearing around the state when the investigator hears the power of attorney, that seems like a real roadblock to a criminal case. But to us, that's a key piece of evidence. And so our response to that, to help those most vulnerable among us, is to use a twofold approach. So there's the training and the outreach to help provide technical assistance so those out in the local communities can help do the cases themselves. But in some of the more complex cases, we do the investigations and the prosecutions if that's necessary. So here I have a slide that I wanted to show you just to identify the scope of the District Attorney Assistance Program. So we have cases in all, or in 35 of the 36 counties. I haven't talked to Wade McLeod to know why Sherman County hasn't called on us just yet. But otherwise, we are...
Wade, right?
Wade, yeah. So we do have cases across the state, as you can tell. We have the darker green are the homicide cases that we have, and we just recently had been asked by Steve Atchison in Columbia County to take on a homicide case there as well. So you can see that the impact is definitely statewide. So in the next slide I have here, kind of speaking to who's using our services. So these are the service assist calls. These are when we get the call on the phone for help with, you know, maybe in the middle of trial or a motion or something like that. So this is a distribution of those calls. And we've had nearly 1,200 in this last biennium of calls from DAs and law enforcement. And again, you can see, which may be surprising to some of the prosecutors and law enforcement in eastern side of the state, that Multnomah County does, in fact, call us more than anybody else. One case I wanted to share with you that was prosecuted by our office, in my view, really highlights the importance of our district attorney assistance program. So Mr. Peterson was a former rural fire district chief, and in that capacity, he obtained grant money and fire equipment to use for the Monument Rural Fire District. When he left, he took with him some of the equipment and some of the money. When the fire district tried to get that money back and the equipment back to use, it's a public safety issue. The local law enforcement officer did not initiate an investigation and was unwilling to initiate an investigation. So the local district attorney turned to our office and OSP, and we did a joint investigation. And our role in that investigation was to do the financial aspect of the case. We were also responsible for doing the prosecution. And so we did that. And a Grant County jury convicted Mr. Peterson of aggravated theft and possession of a stolen vehicle. And what's so compelling to me about this case is, but for the efforts of our office, this case wouldn't have been prosecuted. And the judge who actually imposed sentence in this case just called it a case of plain old thievery.
What year was that?
Members of the committee, Senator Frederick, this was, the trial was in August of this year. Of 16, excuse me.
It's very, very interesting. Considering what Grant County was going through in other ways, so that's very, very interesting.
Same sheriff.
Same sheriff.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Yep. Right, ladies, gentlemen. Continue.
The next part of the special investigations and prosecution section that I want to discuss with you is our Internet Crimes Against Children Unit, which is staffed with two general fund special agent investigators and two federally funded investigators. The role of the Internet Crimes Against Children Unit is to address the sexual exploitation of children online through investigations and prosecutions, but also through education and outreach. One of the primary functions they do is they receive tips from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children about children being exploited online. And those tips originally go to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children can come from, well, most often I would say they come from Internet service providers, other service providers, sometimes other law enforcement agencies and citizens. Those tips come in, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children tries to identify where in the world are those coming from. When they identify Oregon, they share those tips with us. We take those tips in, we process those tips, we try to triage them, identify the ones that are in most need of some law enforcement response. We work with our local partners to address those. So you can see here that we received almost 2,000 cyber tips, and what's significant about that is each of those cyber tips represents an instance in at least which a child could have been or is currently being exploited, and often in some cases, I should say, we look at a cyber tip and it looks like maybe there's a single instance where somebody shared an sexually explicit image of a child using Gmail or something. And when we actually look into the case and we involve local law enforcement, we find out there's actually children involved that are being exploited, hands-on offenses. So here is some of the stats. We would like to do more of these prosecutions that we can, but given some resource limitations, we focus on the ones that are the most complex and do what we can to encourage and support the local law enforcement. Here is just another slide I wanted to share with you that again shows the impact of how many of these cyber tips we get, and again, it's a statewide issue. I just want to talk with you about our organized crime section. Our goal in the organized crime section is to investigate long-term complex cases that involve multiple counties. We want to add value to the local law enforcement in a way that and to help out on cases they could not do themselves. This particular section was created in 1977 directly to combat organized crime and to share information and work with our local partners. One of the key aspects of that we do is we utilize the crime of racketeering. We have legal expertise in the crime of racketeering. What's so important about that is that rather than look at crime as single incidents in a single county, almost like snapshots, through racketeering we can show basically a movie. We can show the entirety of the organization, and that's very important. And we have the prosecutors and the special agents in our office are particularly skilled technologically. They're experienced in these types of cases, and it's a real asset to local law enforcement.
Is that also primarily up north, too?
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, no, actually it is across the state. I don't have a slide for that, only because we have some ongoing investigations I don't want to identify exactly where they are. The other core function of the organized crime section.
Serious, though, given that we have actually the voters decided that we could have recreational marijuana now along with our medical marijuana, is that changing this particular issue at all?
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, it's not changing it for our division. The way the organized crime section works, and you asked earlier about how we get our cases, is we look to the local law enforcement and local leadership in the communities to identify what their needs are, and we work to meet their needs. So if they have a particular organization that is being disruptive in their community and they need help, we try to bring with it every tool in our arsenal through our legal skills, through our technical know-how, through our surveillance techniques. And so using those tools in the various cases, we haven't had a change. And from what I know, methamphetamine remains the
I wasn't talking about meth. In the earlier discussions when we were talking about, you know, doing particularly with recreational marijuana, there was some discussion that with that, hopefully, that we would be able to actually get at some of the other organized crime issues that were associated with that particular crop before we started recreational marijuana. I think that's a delicate way of putting it.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, I'm not sure I fully understand your question.
Well, before it became legal in Oregon, there was a lot of crop grow in Oregon.
Co-Chair Winters, members of the committee, if you're asking me if there's less crop grow in Oregon.
On the illegal side.
On the illegal side.
Yes.
I will follow up on your question. I can tell you that it's difficult because, to be blunt, a lot of efforts from the law enforcement perspective have shifted away from marijuana interdiction. And so it's difficult to know between what is actually happening and what we know is happening. But I definitely have access to information that would be relevant to that point.
I just want to know if we made any impact on those cartels.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, I can tell you that our division has not been asked, and we have okay. not been working in those in any marijuana cartels.
Thank you.
Okay. The other core function I was talking about in the organized crime section is the investigation of allegations involving public officials. As you know, that this is a vital part of ensuring the integrity of Oregon government is a robust ability to investigate these types of allegations. In many instances, we're really the only entity that can do these types of investigations given the conflict of interest at the local level. And what we do, just to share with you, is that we get a lot of allegations that come in regarding public officials. We meet together and we evaluate those allegations to determine whether or not we think that there's a reasonable cause to believe a crime has been committed. And it's not until we can make that determination that we actually open an investigation. And then once we do open an investigation, we do our best to be impartial, professional, and thorough, and to complete them as quickly as we can, because unanswered allegations of corruption in any local community can be very disruptive. In the capacity of the organized crime section, as you note on the slide, we also serve as OSP's forfeiture counsel. Here's a slide demonstrating, again, the scope of our involvement across the state in public corruption cases. We have a total of currently 48 cases in 23 counties. I should say over this last biennium, I don't know if some of those cases perhaps have been closed in this biennium. So one thing we talked about earlier, too, is just about which counties that we do assistance for. And I did mention earlier, a lot of our case assistance deals with the smaller and medium counties, but here's a good example in when it deals with our largest county, the Multnomah County. So in this case, there was two scrap metal businesses that were doing an auto theft ring where they would have people go out and steal the cars and bring them back, and they would scrap them, and ensnared over 100 victims. So we worked with Portland Police Bureau and the DA's office, and we used a wiretap and other advanced investigative techniques to conduct the investigation. And what's great about this particular case, that the investigation was so thorough in the way that we operated it, is that of the 8 people and 2 corporations charged with racketeering and the 30 others charged with related crimes, all of them have pled except for one person has absconded. That's how powerful using these advanced techniques can be in this complex type of crimes. The last section I want to talk about is our Criminal Information Services section. This section is vital to Oregon law enforcement. It helps to ensure that we have a mechanism for communication and collaboration among law enforcement. Some have said asking law enforcement in this day and age to operate without the ability to share information and gather criminal information about offenders is like asking somebody to do a burglary investigation without a DNA or a fingerprint analysis. It's just that vital. So in addition to helping to share information and collect information in a timely and informative manner, we also provide strategic and tactical criminal analysis. I'm going to delve into deeper detail about that here in this slide. So this is the makeup of our Criminal Information Services section. It's the Watch Center and HIDA and the Fusion Center. I will touch now a little bit on what the Watch Center and HIDA do. So the Watch Center is federally funded through the HIDA program. And there are 4 analysts that receive calls from law enforcement that need help with identifying suspects, help in a criminal investigation. They provide those types of services. They can also enter information when they have reasonable suspicion that a crime is committed about a person into the Western States Information Network, which is an intelligence database that other officers have access to. The other thing they do is deconfliction of law enforcement operations, which is essential. So that's a situation in which maybe it's a drug team is going to do a search warrant on a particular house. They call us and let us know, so that if you have maybe a federal agency is going to do another operation down the street, they know, and those two agencies can talk to each other. So it's an officer safety issue, so not two agencies are going at the same target at the same time. That's what deconfliction is. We have the high-intensity drug trafficking areas, which is a federally funded program. We are the investigative services section, and what we have is analysts in our division who help do strategic analysis, which is looking at long-term crime trends so that policymakers can identify where to put money. That's how we know the different drugs we have in Oregon that are the most dangerous and the most prevalent. Then we offer, through the HIDA program, specific case support in the HIDA counties. So that's putting cases together in terms of organizing voluminous amounts of information in a way that's digestible, that's understandable, that can help develop investigative leads. So it might be taking a bunch of phone calls and identifying how different individuals are connected. That's the type of the work that they do. That's similar to the work of one of our limited duration analysts in the Fusion Center who does that type of casework, and I have an example of that to share with you what that kind of analytical casework looks like. We also do what are called threat assessments, which threat assessments can be of key events or locations, and it identifies threats that might be visited upon either that event or that location. And it can be a location like a courthouse, it can be the Pendleton Roundup. So they identify potential threats and, if appropriate, ways to mitigate those threats. So that's a service that we provide. Other, again, critical, the information sharing aspect, which is letting officers know about different criminal activity in particular areas, and letting them know about officer safety issues. A kind of a big example of that would be the Pedersen-Grigsby case. That was four homicides in three states from a few years ago, if you recall. We issued a bulletin at the request of the state police who was conducting that investigation. That bulletin found its way into the hands of a police officer in California who actually identified the suspects using that bulletin. And then also the significance of that bulletin was is that the officer then knew the threat that he was dealing with and can take appropriate measures when apprehending the suspects. That's how critical that can be. So here's a case I wanted to share with you just to kind of give you an example of the type of analytical casework that our division does. So in this particular case, you had a Parks and Rec patrol officer who set fires to multiple houses on park property. In dealing with the investigation, he told the investigators that he wasn't at that location. So from an investigative standpoint, there's two things you want to do. You want to be able to show that what he's telling you about where his location is not true, and you also want to put him at the location of where the fires actually occurred. So what our criminal analyst did, who's currently in the Fusion Center position, she gathered the phone records to identify which cell towers he was making phone calls from during the relevant time period, and she put together this chart. And you can see from it that the suspect claims to be at an entirely different location than where his phone is. And so that's the kind of things that they do, is they take that kind of information. An investigator can take it and say, "What can you help me with this? What can you make of it?" And they do that in a very efficient way. That's what they're trained and experienced in doing. I have a slide here just talking about some of our budgetary issues, and just in a nutshell, what this is that given the unique services that we provide across the state, we are fairly stretched to the limit. We have had a recent case out of Klamath County where the DA's office asked for help on an aggravated murder, and unfortunately, at the timing of that case and when it was set, we weren't able to help on that particular case. So in those types of situations, what we do is we find other ways to help the county. Can we help you with motions on that case? Can we take other cases off of your plate that aren't that looming in terms of a deadline or that voluminous in the amount of work? But that tells you just how stretched we are, and it becomes when we get additional case or if we have to take over another DA's office, that really puts some strain on our office. And the downside to that in some cases is like when we're dealing with our public corruption cases, we take them on because we're the people to do it, but it takes longer than we otherwise would hope to be because of our resources. The remaining slides address our policy packages, which I understand will be addressed in a separate presentation, as well as our reductions. But I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Questions? I don't have any questions, but I if you will indulge me for just a second, if you notice, one of the members on our panel is really, really looking really great today.
Well, thank you.
Yes, because today is a special day for Representative Barker.
Saturday was the actual
special Saturday day. Day. Well, we can...
April Fool's baby?
April Fool's baby.
Yep. Yes. So...
Birthday?
We want to wish you a happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
We do indeed want to wish you a happy birthday. If I might, happy birthday,
happy
Barker.
Birthday.
Happy birthday.
You look great.
Yes, mine's
on
Wednesday.
We thought it was for us.
Mine's the 15th, and I won't be here, so...
Okay.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, Representative Barker, happy birthday. My name is Lisa Edlin, and I am Chief Counsel of our Civil Enforcement Division. The work of the Civil Enforcement Division is some of the most varied, and I personally think some of the most interesting in the department. Our work focuses on protecting Oregon children, families, and consumers, as well as on preserving and recovering state resources. The Civil Enforcement Division employs approximately 100 lawyers and 100 staff divided among offices in six cities: Portland, Salem, Eugene, Pendleton, Bend, and Medford. Our work is divided into five sections or units representing the different types of legal work we do. And I'll briefly walk you through each of these units next. First up is our Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section. The legislature has empowered the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section to protect Oregon consumers from fraud in their purchases of goods and services and to promote competition and ensure a fair marketplace for consumers. The work is fully self-funded through civil penalties and settlements paid to the department's protection and education account. We use the funds we bring in to accomplish a number of very important tasks. First, we educate consumers in a number of ways. We employ an outreach coordinator who presents information to consumer groups throughout the state and coordinates the department's involvement in annual events such as the Scam Jam. We print and circulate educational materials on a number of topics important to consumers. For example, how to deal with telemarketers or door-to-door salesmen, and how consumers can recognize and protect themselves from all the various scams out there today. We print these materials in English, Spanish, and Russian. We also issue consumer alerts to quickly inform consumers of the latest scams. One very important part of our work is maintaining a staff of volunteers who operate our consumer hotline. These volunteers field over 40,000 calls each year, and in addition, we receive about 7,000 written complaints each year. And in case you are interested, I've included on our slide the hotline number in case you'd like to circulate that. We also publish each year a top 10 list of consumer complaints to help inform the public, and I've included that here in case you are interested. Our staff generally reviews complaints and works to assist the complainant and the business in reaching a resolution. Although a great number of complaints are resolved in this process, sometimes that does not work and we need to head to litigation. Our litigation can range from very small to very large. On the large side, our attorneys recently led a multi-state action against Volkswagen. Volkswagen was marketing its vehicles as having clean diesel technology when in fact they were installing defeat devices to get past Oregon emission standards. The settlement resulted in substantial relief to Oregon consumers, including buyback offers, restitution, and a significant payment to our protection and education account. More locally, we stopped a gas station in Independence from contaminating gas with water, which was causing damage to various vehicles. This resulted in restitution for all the consumers. We stopped a company in Portland from preying on minorities and low-income individuals by making high-interest car loans, some as high as 243% interest, and then repossessing the vehicles without good cause. As a result, we obtained an injunction against the company stopping their actions and were able to get restitution for the consumers. In White City, we shut down a fraudulent magazine subscription renewal service. The company was renewing magazines they didn't have authority to renew, and often extending the term beyond the lifetime of an expected lifetime of the seniors who were renewing their subscriptions. As a result, we shut down the company nationwide, and the customers received restitution. These are just a few examples of the important work this unit does to protect consumers every day. Next, we have our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. The Medicaid Fraud Unit operates a federally mandated program to address fraudulent practices in Oregon's Medicaid program and the Oregon Health Plan. The unit focuses on physical or financial abuse and neglect by Medicaid and Oregon Health Plan providers, as well as physical or financial abuse to residents of long-term care facilities. The unit provides specialized assistance to district attorneys, as well as training and education to the public to help reduce fraud and abuse. The Medicaid Fraud Unit is funded through a combination of federal funds, a 75% match, with the remainder 25% funded through penalties and settlements achieved by the work of the unit. In the past several years, the Medicaid Fraud Unit has seen a large increase in the number of case referrals. For example, as you can see in this slide, referrals have increased from 188 in 2010 to 335 in 2016, which is nearly a 78% increase. As a result, we've submitted a POP for additional position authority, which we will discuss in the subsequent phase of our budget hearings. Our Medicaid Fraud Unit in Oregon is regularly recognized as one of the best in the country. The unit consistently achieves positive results with a small number of staff, And I've included a chart here. You can see in the federal fiscal year 2015, Oregon obtained 39 convictions with 15 staff. And I've included surrounding states so you can get a sense of the success of our unit. Some examples of their work include conviction of a woman who was acting as a professional fiduciary for a number of Oregonians, including many disabled veterans. This woman was diverting all of their funds, many of their funds, to her own personal use. She was convicted and sentenced to 48 months in prison and ordered to pay more than $117,000 in restitution. We also worked collaboratively to convict a Portland pharmacist who was defrauding patients and Medicaid by he was substituting two and a half cent Costco fish oil pills instead of the name brand medication, but charging Medicaid and Medicare the full cost of the brand name prescription. This gentleman was sentenced to 20 years in prison and paid over $800,000 in restitution to Medicare and Medicaid. Last, I'd like to show you a video. This was taken in the Marion County Courthouse just down the street. And if you watch the woman in white walking there, Medicaid paid this woman's home care worker $100,000 over 5 years because the woman allegedly was wheelchair-bound and lacked the strength to even propel herself. She claimed she was unable to feed herself because she could not hold a utensil and required a full-time cook and housekeeper. As you can see, none of that was true. As a result of the investigation and the work of our unit, both the home care worker and the recipient were convicted of multiple felonies. Let's see if I can stop that. Next is our charitable activities section. The charitable activities section works hard to foster an environment where charitable donors can make informed decisions and donate money with confidence. This is done through regulating charities and gaming in Oregon, licensing professional fundraising firms and nonprofit gaming such as bingo, raffles, and Monte Carlo, curtailing misleading charitable solicitations, and identifying and correcting breaches of fiduciary duty by officers and directors of charities. The section is funded entirely through registration fees, which are based on a sliding scale. Oops, I apologize. The number of charities in Oregon has been growing steadily. There are currently over 20,000 registered charities in Oregon compared to only 14,000 charities in the year 2006. The section works cooperatively with charitable organizations to resolve compliance issues. However, they will take enforcement action where necessary. During this past biennium, the unit took action against a non-profit foster care home, its executive director, and related charities for misuse of charitable assets. The unit was able to recover funds and real estate, exceeding over $1 million, and obtained injunctive relief prohibiting the executive director from managing charities in the future. The section joined with the Federal Trade Commission and 49 other states in shutting down the Cancer Fund of America. This so-called charity raised over $180 million through false solicitations, indicating that the money would be used to assist cancer patients, when in fact most of that money went to telemarketers and to the family members who were running the charity. In addition, this unit uncovered the embezzlement of approximately $140,000 from a charity providing housing to recovering substance abusers. This case was referred to the Multnomah County District Attorney, who used the financial information we compiled to obtain a conviction of the people involved. Finally, this section works hard to provide public education. For example, they frequently work with members of the nonprofit community to educate directors on what their legal responsibilities are. Next is our civil recovery section. This is a very diverse section within
a very
diverse...
Would you go back to the comment that you made with working with the nonprofit communities so they understand what their responsibilities are? And are you doing any work with boards? Because most boards do not know that they've got a fiduciary responsibility.
True. Chair Winters, members of the committee, my understanding is that our staff does reach out to and provide training for board members. We try to get that information out publicly so people can attend trainings, and we do work individually with boards.
And if I might add, I believe, I'm not sure if it's up to date, but we do have a brochure that we provide to board members of nonprofits.
I think that's excellent because so often individuals sign up to be on a board and they just think they're there.
Yeah.
without understanding their responsibility and their role and that they are responsible.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, that is true. There are a lot of responsibilities that come that people don't understand, and we do our best to educate
them. And not only that, I think that's also true of our own boards and commissions. Maybe we may give you another task.
Right. Attorneys in the civil recovery section are responsible for a broad range of legal tasks. They generally act as the state's plaintiff's lawyer, enforcing laws and bringing actions on behalf of state agencies. The section litigates all claims for money or property owed to the state and assists agencies seeking legal relief and protecting their interests in bankruptcy. Some examples of the section's recent work include assisting DHS to recover $1.6 million in overpayment claims, personal injury liens, and collecting debt and Medicaid estate recovery. Assisting the Department of Forestry in recovering nearly $6 million in fire suppression costs. And assisting state licensing boards and agencies in obtaining adjunctive relief, such as prohibiting the unlicensed practice of chiropractic services and massage therapy. One of the largest growth areas for attorneys in the civil recovery section is working on guardianship and conservatorship matters with the Oregon Public Guardian and Conservator, particularly when it seeks to be appointed guardian for incapacitated adults and helping the Department of Veterans Affairs to recover money owed to incapacitated veterans.
Senator Steiner-Hayward has a question.
Senator Steiner-Hayward has a question. This is something Senator Winters and I spent a lot of time thinking about, because we sit in this direction in the Human Services Subcommittee where we hear about this other side of this program. Could you talk a little bit about how that's been going and working with the new guardianship program that we have for our senior citizens in Oregon, and how you feel like, from your perspective, that program has been proceeding, whether you're getting the kinds of questions and requests for assistance you'd expect? I'm not asking you to throw anybody under the bus if you don't think it's been going well, but we're trying to understand it from multiple perspectives, and you offer a different perspective.
Senator Steinmeier-Hayward, members of the committee, the attorneys I have in the section primarily focus on the guardianship and the conservatorship, and I think we feel that that has been going well. It is a new program, and so we are working our way through, or relatively new, I should say, working our way through that procedure. As far as general counsel type advice, that may be better addressed by Mr. Wolf, who I believe you'll be hearing from momentarily.
Anything else you want to add on to that question?
No, I think we can talk offline, because we had planned to have additional conversation with you, because we did have a presentation from long-term care folks. And so I just think that we need to have some conversation between your office and
Senator Steinmeier-Hayward, Senator Winters, I'd be certainly happy to bring my more knowledgeable staff who are on the ground to discuss that if you'd like.
Thank you.
The goal of the civil recovery section is to generate the maximum recovery at a minimum cost. As you can see from the chart, we've recovered approximately $40 million so far for state agencies in the 2015-2017 biennium. You will also note from the chart some years our large recoveries are even larger when a large punitive damage amount comes into the state. I'd like to contrast the blue bars, which are the amount we're bringing in, with the red on this chart, which is the cost of our program. As you can see from this, it costs very little for us to bring in the amount of money we're bringing in for the state. Civil recovery attorneys also assist Oregon children and families by representing the Division of Child Support in establishing, modifying, and enforcing child support orders, establishing paternity, and pursuing contempt against parents who fail to pay their child support obligations. In the past year, attorneys in the section have pursued over 535 contempt cases for failure to pay child support. When we got these cases, they had parents had received about $100,000. After the contempt actions we instituted, that collection figure went to over $1.3 million, demonstrating that contempt action greatly increases collection payment for Oregon's children. In one recent case, the obligee called our staff to let us know that this was the first child support she had ever recovered, and it allowed her to pay their rent so that she and her children would not be evicted from their home. Staff in the Civil Recovery Section work hard to ensure that our state continues to receive significant funds under the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement. As part of this agreement, the participating tobacco companies pay Oregon between $120 and $160 million each biennium, and those payments continue into perpetuity. To uphold our obligations under the MSA, staff in this section diligently enforce statutes regulating conduct of tobacco product manufacturers. In addition, the unit regulates the sale of tobacco products in Oregon through a registration process referred to as certification. Since approximately 2006, the states participating in the MSA have been involved in a payment dispute with the participating manufacturers. As a result of that dispute, the manufacturers have been withholding approximately $10 million from Oregon's payment each year. At the heart of the dispute is the issue of whether Oregon diligently enforced the terms of its escrow statute during the relevant years. The MSA contains provisions under which a state that loses this dispute could lose its entire MSA payment for the year in question. The MSA requires that the payment disputes be resolved through a nationwide arbitration process before a panel of three retired federal judges. In 2013, Oregon participated in the first such arbitration regarding calendar year 2003. We prevailed in that dispute and ultimately received our full payment for calendar year 2003. We are currently engaged and working toward a similar arbitration with regard to the 2004 year, and it's important to stay fully engaged due to the amount at risk in that case. Last, but by no means least, is our child advocacy section, which represents nearly half of the Civil Enforcement Division. The mission of the child advocacy section is to protect Oregon's children and families by providing legal representation to DHS's child welfare program. Attorneys in this section represent DHS in juvenile dependency matters, termination of parental rights cases, and administrative hearings. They provide legal advice to DHS to ensure compliance with relevant law and to assist DHS in forming its policies. Examples of the work include assisting children who have been abandoned without birth certificates to obtain information needed to allow a court to issue a vital statistics order so that they can obtain obtain the documents they need to get driver's licenses, passports, and other important legal documents. Working through complicated legal jurisdiction issues to help free children for adoption, for example, dealing with competing cases, for example, in other states or even other countries, addressing cases where children are at risk due to physical and mental abuse by their parents, or working on cases where one parent has fled the state with the children to avoid dealing with their substance and mental health abuse issues. An important part of our work this past year has centered around the Task Force on Legal Representation in Childhood Dependency, which was enacted by the 2015 legislature through Senate Bill 222. The goal of the task force was to review and assess the current systems and business models used to provide legal representation for the government, parents, and children in juvenile dependency cases, and provide recommendations regarding how to improve the dependency representation system and related practices in Oregon to protect due process and improve child welfare outcomes. Department of Justice, primarily through Deputy Attorney General Fred Dallas and my Deputy Joanne Southey, participated actively in the task force, which convened 10 monthly meetings throughout the state and issued a final report in August of 2016. The report recognized that high-quality, consistent dependency representation is essential to protect children and improve outcome for families, safeguard fairness and due process in the dependency system, ensure lawful decisions are made based on all relevant information, and confirm that attorneys have the necessary expertise to champion and support system improvements. As a result of the task force, the legislature is currently considering House Bill 2345 and Senate Bill 525. In particular, House Bill 2345 includes the task force recommendations regarding legal representation for DHS, parents and children, and CASA advocates. It is of great importance to DOJ that these bills recognize the importance of providing caseworkers with quality legal representation in court so that caseworkers can focus on the important work they do with families and children rather than on practicing law. These bills address funding DHS caseworker representation by allowing DOJ to provide comprehensive agency representation through a block grant or flat fee, model, which will allow DHS to leverage their federal funds and reimbursement programs. The model does not eliminate the state as a party in the dependency cases, but rather allows DHS, who is the child legal guardian, to direct resources to the entity providing legal representation to their agency. This slide is our policy packages, which we've mentioned, and I understand we will discuss reductions at a subsequent phase. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Winters, Co-Chair Stark, members of the committee, my name is Steve Wolf. I am Chief Counsel of the Department's General Counsel Division. Our division provides the legal services our client agencies need to administer their programs and advance their missions on a day-to-day basis. We serve over 100 state boards and commissions, and our focus is on providing preventative legal services, giving our client agencies the advice and offering the kinds of trainings that can help them to identify and head off potential legal problems, and also to inform them about the levels of legal risk that various policy options that are available to them pose in order to better inform their own policy choices. Our basic model for providing services is to assign contact counsel to each agency. Our division is organized into 7 subject matter sections under the general management of myself and my Deputy Chief Counsel, Judy Gears. The sections, for example, the Health and Human Services section represents those state agencies, including Oregon Health Authority and DHS that provide human services. Tax and Finance represents revenue, treasury, et cetera. And in those sections, we assign individual attorneys to the agencies to serve as their primary contact. So often, in most cases, we are sort of the face of the department for those agencies. A couple of our sections don't operate strictly on the client contact model. For example, the business transactions section, which handles the state's more difficult and challenging contract matters, assigns work on the basis of subject matter. So we have a design and construction work area, we have an IT work area, and we have a real estate work area. Similarly, the labor and employment section, which represents the state in its capacity as an employer, assigns work among its attorneys on a rotating basis. The bulk of the legal services we provide and our core responsibilities fall into 3 main categories. The first is general legal advice, ordinarily regarding the scope and exercise of the agency's legal authorities, or regarding public law issues such as public records or meetings law, public contracting, etc. The second category is contract review and drafting, and that includes mandatory legal sufficiency review. The third category, major category, is representing client agencies in contested case hearings and other types of litigation. We also serve the state and the department by performing other functions, including, for example, preparing drafts of the published opinions the department generates, including the Attorney General opinions. We also help prepare the Attorney General manuals, and we provide agency legal trainings. Those trainings include the Attorney General's public law conference, which I'll talk about a little more in a few moments. In providing these various services to individual agencies, we strive to speak with one voice and maintain a consistent approach to legal issues in accordance with legal policy articulated and established by the Attorney General. We take the view that we have a single client, which is the state of Oregon, and the state has one attorney, the Attorney General. We are all her surrogates when we are dealing with the state agencies. We're also mindful of the people's interest in the objective interpretation and the uniform and fair application of the state's laws, and the importance of considering the interests of the state as a whole when we're addressing individual legal issues for state agencies. This is very challenging. We have over 100 attorneys serving over 100 clients, dealing with issues that in some cases have spanned decades. So we do the best we can with that. It is a core responsibility of ours. We're very excited that we have coming online soon a new set of legal tools, document management tools, and legal practice tools, which will further our ability to archive, retrieve, and compare advice that we have given and are giving. I want to touch on a few significant projects and programs that highlight the importance of this focus on consistency and uniformity. The first of those is the recreational marijuana legislation and program, beginning with the passage of Measure 91 in 2014. This legislation and ensuing legislation impact almost all agencies and programs, ranging from those that are charged with direct responsibility for implementing and administering the program to those affected by the general public law ramifications of the program. These issues include banking issues, the intersection of the medical and recreational programs, employment issues, many others. So with the passage of Measure 91, we stood up an interdivisional task force under the supervision of my deputy, Judy Gears, to coordinate the services our clients request and need regarding this matter. Another very wide-ranging and important program is the Portland Harbor Superfund Project. A team of attorneys, mostly in our natural resources section, under the leadership of the attorney in charge, Paul Garahand, and senior assistant attorney general, Don Pyle, is engaged with that vital undertaking, which has entered a new and significant phase with the EPA's recent issuance of its record of decision in the matter. Multiple state agencies are involved in various roles, either as potentially responsible parties, as in the case of ODOT and state lands, or as regulating agencies, as in the case of DEQ and ODFW. That goal of promoting consistent approach to legal issues across the entire state enterprise carries through our approach to some of the wider ranging for the good of the state initiatives we undertake. It underlies the public law conference and our other client trainings and informs our approach to the AG manuals and other client publications General Counsel has a hand in preparing. I'll talk a little bit about more those in a moment, but I did want to take a moment also to mention our flat charge pilot project, which we've set up as an alternative to our ordinary build hour model. The General Counsel division is wholly other funded, and that is almost solely in our hourly billings to our state agencies. Over the last three biennia, we have offered some agencies, mostly small boards and commissions, the opportunity to pay a flat charge for all of the legal services DOJ will provide in the coming biennium. The charge is calculated based on a rolling three biennia average of that agency's use of our services. We currently have 19 agencies enrolled in the pilot. As I say, these are mostly small agencies, and they found it to be a great boon for a couple of reasons. One, it gives them predictability of what their legal services will be. Because they do have small budgets for the most part, they will sometimes tend to husband their resources against the day that they might have a big case. We like to see the agencies engage us earlier when we can be more proactive and provide that sort of preventative legal service that's of value to them. So the agencies like the sort of insurance aspect of the flat charge model, knowing that they can request our services, and if they are hit by an unexpected, say, big contested case that's going to cost them a fair amount of money in legal services, that won't hit their current biennium budget, that will be smoothed over the ensuing biennia. So that's worked very well for those agencies so far. We're looking to incrementally expand it further, invite other agencies, and we think it has a lot of promise for the future. I did want to mention the Attorney General's Public Law Conference in 2015. Attorney General Rosenblum did authorize and revive the Public Law Conference, which had been last previously held in 2007. It was an enormous success. It got almost universal praise from our client agencies. Over 700 state employees attended some or all of the two-day program, which consisted of more than 30 training sessions on subjects ranging from how to conduct contested case hearings to how to draft contracts to how to work with the legislature. We'll be holding that again this year. Yes, I may take that training this year. We'll be holding that again this year on October 24th and 25th at the Salem Convention Center. And General Counsel takes the lead role in organizing and mounting that conference. I mentioned earlier our role in publishing the Attorney General manuals, which we strive to make a valuable resource for both our client agencies and for the public at large. Our goal is to publish new editions of all the manuals after the end of the current legislative session, and we hope before the start of the public law conference, and then to keep that biennial publication and updating schedule going forward. One of the challenges we face with, again, initiatives of this kind, the manuals, and the public law conference is that it doesn't fit easily into our funding model, the build our funding model. And so we have to find other ways to account for the attorney time that goes into those. That remains a challenge. We do it with the public law conference, partly by charging a fee to the agencies, which partly recoups the cost. Similarly, with the manuals, we do charge for the manuals. Our goal, ultimately, is to make all of the manuals available free on our website online. We do that currently with the Public Records and Meetings Law Manual. We'd like to do it with the others. Partly, that's just figuring out how to make that work financially for us, given our current model. Again, our policy packages and reductions, I think, will be subject to discussion at a later date, but I am more than delighted to field any questions anyone might have for me.
Questions? I don't think so. I think you did a good job.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your kind attention.
So I think that it's very appropriate at this time, though, however, that since we have a few minutes, and if you'll indulge me, I think we should sing happy birthday to Representative Barker.
You did sing happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Jeff. Happy birthday to you.
And many more.
Thank you.
And if there's no further questions or comments, we are adjourned. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And that's on the record now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I can pull that and stream that to my wife.